That's always my favorite part when y'all clap. I like this. Tim T's from Cleveland. They just clap. I haven't done anything yet, you know? Y'all are happy to see me, and I appreciate that. But right now, I want to thank the people that have done something so far, and that's the committee that makes it possible for us to be here tonight to share with each other. Let's give them a round of applause. I really didn't know if we were going to make it yesterday morning. We had no power and no water for about 13 hours, and the airport was still closed when we got there yesterday at 7 o'clock. But I was worried about Jerry. I had to make it. I just thought about him standing up here on Saturday night and saying, I'm sorry, our speakers couldn't make it. In Cleveland, they're in a blackout. And I just knew I'd never be invited anywhere else again, you know. And we got it figured out right quick. Lack of power, that was our dilemma up there, you know. I got to thank some people on a personal note. Dave and Brian, who picked us up at the airport, and Roy and Dottie, who took us to dinner tonight and been looking after us. And about 2 years ago, I got diagnosed with something called hepatitis C. And just about a year ago, they put me on an interferon treatment for it. And it's pretty hard treatment. I'm down about 25, 26 pounds, and my hair's falling out, and it sucks the life out of you. And so the people I want to thank are the people I have to put up with me every day through that. And that would be the guys I work with in my office, Mark and Bob and Bill and Sandy. And, of course, my wife, who takes the brunt of the treatment. She's probably harder on her than it is on me, the way I have to act sometimes. So I do want to thank her and those people for, and they also make it possible for me to be here tonight. Now, I'm pretty sure what I'm going to say tonight. I'm not pretty sure what you're going to hear, though. And there's a story I like to tell. And it's a story about a state trooper. And this state trooper sitting on the side of the road, just doing what state troopers do, waiting for somebody to do something wrong. And here comes a boy driving a pickup truck. And the back of that pickup truck is full of penguins. And he knows there's something wrong with that. And so he pulled that boy over. He says, "Son, where are you going with all those penguins?" And he said, "We're not going anywhere, officer. We're just going for a ride." He said, "What? You can't take penguins for a ride. You take them penguins to the zoo." And he said, "Yes, sir." And he drove off. The next day, that trooper, he's sitting in the same spot. Here comes that pickup truck. Pickup truck still full of penguins. Except today, those penguins all have sunglasses on. He pulled them over again. He said, "Boy, I thought I told you to take those penguins to the zoo." He said, "Well, yes, sir, I did. And today we're going to the beach." My name's Tim Towsley, and I am an alcoholic. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I planned not to be an alcoholic. My daddy was an alcoholic. He was a member of this fellowship. He got sober in 1946. He passed away in 1980. He had 10 years of sobriety put together at that time in his life. And what that did for me at an early age gave me an opportunity to see what an alcoholic was all about, see what alcoholism was all about, and also to see what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. I came from a family where I had 6 stepfathers. I had 13 stepmothers. I went to over 20 schools, and I never got out of the 8th grade. I've been married 3 times and divorced twice. I left home when I was 14 years old. I've had an opportunity in my life to spend time in boys' homes, detention homes, city jails, county jails, workhouses, psych wards, treatment centers, and penitentiaries. I spent 12 years of my life either on probation, parole, or or locked behind some kind of door somewhere. And do you know not one of those things I just mentioned are the reasons I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous? Those were merely the situations that my disease of alcoholism created in my life. But on June 23rd, 1982, I woke up at the bottom. And that's the bottom they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. When you know a loneliness such as few men know, that's when you're at that jumping off place. You're wishing for the end. You can no longer imagine life with or life without alcohol. That's the bottom. And that's not a high bottom. But you know, that's not a low bottom either. That's my bottom. And that's the only bottom I ever need to concern myself with is my bottom. I don't ever want to be in a position in my sobriety where I can sit in a room of alcoholics, listen to a speaker speak, and start thinking things like, you know, maybe I wasn't that bad. Or maybe I was worse. Because as soon as I can sit out there and I can make myself believe I'm unique in any way from anybody else that's sitting in this room, if I can believe that I'm different, then I have reservations. There was an old timer in Cleveland where I got sober, used to tell me all the time. He said, Tim, you know something? If you got reservations, son, you must be going somewhere, huh? I don't want to go anywhere today. I like it here. I had my first drink at 13. I got sick. I got drunk. I got sick. I passed out. I blacked out. And I woke up in the backyard of a lady's house in Rocky River, Ohio. I had my last drink at 30. And I got sick. And I got drunk. And I passed out. And I blacked out. And I woke up at home in bed. And you know, that's the only difference in 17 years of use and abuse was where I woke up the next morning. Most of those days were pretty much the same from then on out. But I know this today. I know God wants me here in Alcoholics Anonymous. That woman came out of her back door. She found me in her backyard. Took me in her house. She cleaned me up. She laid me down. She found out who I was. She called my mama and let my mama know I was okay. 17 years later, I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sober about 2 weeks, and I went to a meeting. And that lady was speaking at that meeting that night. My very first drunk, I found myself in the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what she did for me that night? She was sober 3 months that night she found me in her backyard. And she did what they told her to do at her meeting, and that was help a drunk. And that's what she did. She helped the drunk. And they didn't tell her only help the young drunks or the old drunks, the white drunks or the black drunks, the male drunks or the female drunks. They told her help a drunk, period. And that's what she did. And you know that's what she still does? That woman's over 80 years old and is getting ready to celebrate 40 years of sobriety. She's still helping drunks. Now there's two things I ran from most of my life. I have a lot of them today. Ran from them my whole life. Still don't like them. Got a pile of them, though. Those two things are responsibility and authority. You know, I don't like being responsible. There's a lot of responsibility involved with being responsible. And I certainly don't like people telling me I'm supposed to be responsible. And it seemed like in my life at 14 years old, excuse me, everybody had an idea about my life, how I was supposed to act, where I was supposed to go, what I was supposed to do, and no one asked me. I was at a family gathering one day, and I'm listening to people talk, and I heard somebody say that my daddy, my real father, was in New Orleans, and he was sober. And with that information, I left home the next day, because that was my problem. It wasn't what I was doing. It was that I didn't have a real father to show me the right way. And I knew if I could find my real daddy, everything would be okay. And I left home and I went to New Orleans. I got there, I called Alcoholics Anonymous, told them what I was doing there. They found my daddy and they put us together. And now all of a sudden I had a father and he had a son. And we tried to be those two things. But you see, neither one of us ever been either of those two things before. We didn't know what we were doing. We did the best we could, but we just didn't know what we were doing. After about 3 months down there, I found something out. My daddy started drinking again. And I remember coming home at 13 and 14 years old, passing out in my mama's living room, and the next morning she's screaming at me. Son, don't drink. Please don't drink. You'll get what your daddy has. But I didn't see what she was trying to keep me from getting until I was in New Orleans, and I watched him drink. And I watched him get drunk. And I watched him go into the DTs. And that's when I called Alcoholics Anonymous my second time. And they came. And they took my daddy out of that little apartment, and they put him in Bridge House in New Orleans. And I didn't have another drink for the next 4 years. I made a decision on that day that I'm not going to be like my daddy. I'm not going to end up like he ended up. I'm not going to be no alcoholic. I didn't do much of anything for the next 4 years but travel. I just hitchhiked all around this country. If I woke up in Los Angeles, didn't like it there, I'd go to San Francisco. If San Francisco didn't please me, I'd go to Denver. If I didn't like Denver, I'd go to Miami. I just did that. And those were 4 good years. My expectations were met. If I had a pack of cigarettes, a sleeping bag, and something to eat that day, it was a good day. That's all I needed out of life. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me this. My expectations are inversely proportional to my serenity level. Huh? And I don't know about you, but I can tell you this about me. Do you know if I get exactly, now I mean exactly, what I think I'm supposed to have, exactly when I think I'm supposed to have it, I'm a pretty happy guy. But as soon as I don't, as soon as those expectations aren't met, my serenity level starts dropping. And all of a sudden, I want something else out of life. I've been doing that for 4 years and I'm tired. All of a sudden, I want some of that stuff I see on the other sides of the freeway, some of that stuff they're telling me about on the billboards. You know the ones that tell us, you know, if you drive this kind of car, you're okay. If you live in that kind of neighborhood, you're okay. And if you wear these kind of clothes, you're okay. And all of a sudden, I thought I wanted some of that stuff, because if I had the stuff, you'd see it on me. You'd look at me and say, he's got the stuff, he must be okay. You'd tell me I was okay because I couldn't never tell myself. I woke up outside Salt Lake City somewhere, 4, 5, 8 exits east. Guy dropped us off up there, me and a buddy of mine, up in the mountains. We were at an off-ramp where there's nothing. There's no stores, there's no gas stations, there's no houses, there's no nothing except the road that goes up into the Rocky Mountains somewhere. We woke up the next morning. Cold. It's cold in the mountains in the morning. And we thought, if we didn't start moving, we was going to freeze to death. So we walked down to the bottom of that on-ramp in the middle of Utah, in the middle of the Rocky Mountains at 6 o'clock in the morning. You know what was sitting there when we got there? A six-pack of Olympia beer. I know God wants me here. I drank 3 beers. He drank 3 beers. I looked at him, and I told him, you know, if I ever get back to Cleveland alive, I'm settling down. I'm going to marry the first girl I see. She had to have a wife. Black velvet sign got a girl on it. It's part of the American dream. I got home. Stopped at my parents' home. My stepfather wasn't there, so I was allowed in. I took a shower, changed my clothes, borrowed my mother's car, drove to the corner to get a pack of cigarettes, picked a young lady up hitchhiking, and we got married. We didn't get married that day. We might have, but in the state of Ohio, the female had to be 18 or have parental consent, and the male had to be 21 or have parental consent. And when I married my first wife, I was 18 and she was 15. And this was not a marriage that was made in heaven. We didn't know anything about being married. We didn't know anything about anything, matter of fact. I can't tell you today if I love that woman. I can tell you this, though. I live in my brother's van in the driveway of my parents' home because I haven't been allowed in their house since I'm 14 years old. She lives wherever she can because there's stuff going on in her house she just doesn't want to go back to. And that brought us together. And we weren't alone anymore. We didn't need anything else at that point in our lives other than not to be alone anymore. And that was enough then. And it was a simple marriage. I get up in the morning, I get drunk. And she'd get up in the morning, she'd get drunk. And then we'd beat each other up. We did that one day at a time. For about 7 years. But out of 7 years, I was away a lot. I had places to go, people to see, things to do. I still traveled. I was all over the place. I just had different people deciding where I was going. I'd walk into rooms. It's a funny thing. I'd walk into a room like this, and they'd have a big table up here. Be a guy sitting behind it in a black coat. Every time he did this, I went somewhere. I was just always in trouble. Seemed like 12 years of my life, I only did two things. I got ready to go to jail, and I got ready to come home from being in jail. I had a bad attitude. I was always in trouble. I was a child of the 60s, you know? I had a really bad attitude. I was against everything. I got a report card at home from the third grade. You know, you remember your report cards? You used to take them home, show your mama? Teacher would snitch on you on the back of them, and you'd have to have mama sign it to take it back. Third grade report card. You know what it says? Bad attitude. Says Timothy does not play well with others. I'm 8 years old. I haven't had a drink yet, and they know I got a problem. I wasn't a violent criminal. I was a stupid criminal. I got arrested for some dumb things, man. I got arrested for stuff like verbal abuse of a police officer, huh? It was in a little town called Parma, Ohio. I got arrested for obscene finger language to a police officer. And that was in Parma. And if y'all aren't hip to Parma, Ohio, I'm going to tell you this. They got no sense of humor in Parma, Ohio. I was at a meeting one night. I was about 2 years sober, I guess. I don't know about anybody else, but when I was 2 years sober, I was probably the smartest person in Alcoholics Anonymous 2 years sober. I just knew everything. When I got to a meeting, I made sure y'all knew just how much I knew. There's still some old-timers alive in Cleveland to tell you. They remind me of it, too, thank God. But, you know, you ever been to a meeting, you've heard somebody say something, you know you've heard them say it 100 times, but now it makes sense? Huh? A friend of mine is talking that night. He's an old-timer. He's passed away. I just love this man. His past was a lot like mine, only it was like 20, 30 years earlier, you know? He was in jail with all my heroes. You know, I was... all my heroes. You know, I thought I was going to... Like, you know, Pretty Boy Floyd and... You know... Bonnie and Clyde, and those are my heroes. You know, I always thought I was going to be the next Al Capone. All I wound up being was alcoholic, man, you know? But he stood up here that night and he said something, and I know I'd heard him talk before. He said, I've been arrested 63 times. I wasn't a good criminal. Huh? Man, I picked right up on that. I know I've been arrested or charged with 63 crimes. I wasn't a good criminal. People that do what I did and got caught as often as they got caught, they weren't real good at what they were doing. Less, of course, what I was doing was trying to get caught. I learned something else in that verbal abuse of a police officer case. You see, I decided to represent myself in that case. I don't know why everybody laughs when I say that. I just knew I saw enough Perry Mason, Judd, for the defense. You know, I can handle this. And I went to Parma Court, and I called witnesses, and I cross-examined their witnesses, and I gave my final arguments to the judge. And y'all know what I found out, right? I'm not a very good attorney either. Off to the workhouse again. 1975, I stood in front of a judge in that old Lakeside courthouse in downtown Cleveland, and he sentenced me to 20 to 40 years in the penitentiary. I took a big sigh of relief that day. I felt pretty good on that day. Now, I can hear my wife and my mother in the back of the courtroom. They're crying. They don't think I should go away, and they certainly don't think I should go away for that long. But I know something they don't know that day. I know they can't send me anywhere that's going to hurt me as much as I'm hurting me. But I knew it on that day. That judge didn't know that he couldn't punish me as much as I punish me. But on that day, I knew it. And I was ready to go anywhere where I might have a chance against myself. In 1975, the laws changed. My sentence went from a 20 to 40 to a 1 to 10. And 3 years later, they sent me home. But when I came home, all my stuff was gone. All the stuff I needed to fit into your world was gone. To be a member of this society was gone. My wife was gone. My car was gone. My motorcycle was gone. My clothes were gone. My jewelry was gone. Everything I had to have so you'd tell me I was okay was gone. And for the next 3 months, I sat in my little house, and I sat in a chair and I drank. And I got as drunk as I could, passed out as I could, blacked out as I could, every day, as many times a day as I needed to, for the next 3 months. But not once in my life have I ever crawled into a bottle of alcohol to hide from you. I've never crawled into a bottle of alcohol to hide from them. I got as drunk as I could, blacked out as I could, passed out as I could. I crawled in a bottle daily to hide from me. I hid from me in the bottle. I knew what I was. I was an ex-con. I was an ex-husband, I was an ex-brother, and I was an ex-son. I failed at everything I ever tried to do, and if I was drunk enough, I didn't have to look. Finally, a friend of mine came over and took me out of there, almost physically, took me out of my house. He said, "You're coming with me. I'm not going to let you sit in this chair and die. You're out of prison, and it's time to start living again." And he took me down to the flats of Cleveland. This is a long time ago. This is before they ruined the flats of Cleveland. See, we got all, every town I'm in's got some kind of, they're going to fix this part of town up. You know what I mean? They're going to take this part and they're going to make it nice. And the flats of Cleveland used to be just a place you got drunk. That's what you went there for, to get drunk. You didn't go there to go to a fancy restaurant, get on a boat, or drink anything from a microbrewery. There were motorcycles. They sold Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. They had Marshall Tucker songs playing. All the bar room floors were flooded. I don't know with what. I got an idea, though. And he took me down there, and we went into a little bar called the Pirate's Cove. My cousin's band was playing that night, and they were playing a Marshall Tucker song. I'm drinking Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, and I'm about half in the bag. This pretty little girl walked past me. She smiled at me. I smiled right back at her. I was in jail a long time. And that was her. That was my future ex-wife. Who shall heretofore be known as the plaintiff. That's who that was. Let me tell you about my second wife. She came into my home and she had some stuff. I must have had some of this stuff once, but I never kept any of it and didn't know much about it when she got here. But she had stuff she brought with her when she came. She brought stuff like purity with her. She brought honesty, she brought unselfishness, and she brought love. These things she had when she came. And 4 years later, she left. And she only had one thing left to take. And that's the disease of alcoholism. I'm not the only one I hurt when I pick up a drink. And I know that today. I touch a lot of lives. I tried for a couple years. I had a fairly decent job. I was moving up in the company. I was going to their little trade schools to learn how to do it better. 2 years I did that. Never missed a day, never called in sick, was never late for 2 years. You listening to me? I worked 2 years, man. I did the right thing. And you know, sitting on my couch drunk after doing that for 2 years, I took a look around my dynasty. You know, after doing that for 2 years, I didn't have a house on the lake. I didn't have a Lincoln sitting in the driveway. Didn't belong to the right kind of club. Certainly wasn't running around with the right kind of people. And I made a decision that night drunk. Those things are for other people. And no matter what I do, I'm never supposed to have them. And I got up the next morning, called my boss, and quit my job. And I drank. And the next 2 years of my drinking aren't that exciting. I got up, I got drunk. If I got up again that day, I got drunk again that day. That's what I did. And at the end of my drinking, this is my life. My wife lasted almost that whole 2 years, and then she had to go. She had nothing left to take but that disease. It stripped all those decent things she had. You know those family gatherings we have? Maybe it's Christmas, Thanksgiving, Easter. We'll go somewhere. We'll sit around the table, we'll hold hands, and we'll say grace. We'll share a meal, and then we'll share what's going on in our lives with each other. This is the way it works at my house. I drive to my parents' home, and I pull in the driveway. I blow the horn. When they hear the horn inside, my little brother comes out of the back door. He's got a paper plate in his hand, and he hands it to me. That's my holiday meal. I'm allowed to sit in my car in my parents' driveway and eat my holiday meal off a paper plate with a plastic knife and a plastic fork. I can't sit at their table. I can't hold their hands and say grace. I can't have a real napkin. And they certainly don't want me to share anything with them that's going on in my life at that point. But I don't want you to think they stopped loving me, not even this much. Did their love diminish for me at that time in my life? They simply realized that every time they reached down and stopped me from hitting my bottom, they were hurting me. Every time they allowed me not to be responsible for my own actions, they were helping to kill me. My parents loved me so much, they let me go. I don't have any children, so I can only imagine how much love that must have. I got a dog at this time in my life. I got a Doberman. I got a dumb Doberman. I said that at a meeting in Cleveland years ago. Some guy came up to me afterwards. He said, "Dumb Doberman is redundant." So I went right home and looked up redundant. You know he's right. I'd come home, I'd get the dog, I'd take the dog outside, tie him to a tree. Go back out there a half hour later, bring him in the house. As soon as he walked in the house, he peed on the floor. I don't know what he thought he was doing out there on that tree. He probably just standing out there wondering why I tied him to a tree. Right before my wife left, I got up one morning, I made that phone call to her office, just like I always did, see if she left me any wine money or cigarette money laying around the house. And when she got on the phone that morning, she was frantic. She said, "Where's the dog?" And I said, "The dog's laying on the bed right next to me, just where he's supposed to be." She said, "Be careful of the dog." I said, "What do you mean, be careful of the dog?" She said, "I thought the dog was going to hurt you last night. It was growling and showing his teeth." That I was really afraid. I said, well, what happened? And you see, apparently, she says, I came home in a blackout that night. I walked into the bedroom, and I peed on the bedroom floor. So you know, that poor dog, he's sitting there thinking, that dirty SOB's kicked my ass 100 times for doing that, you know? Even my dog's got a resentment at this time in my life. I got up that next morning. It was July 23rd, 1982, and I woke up at that bottom I told you about. And I didn't know what to do. And I always did the same thing in my life when I didn't know what to do. I made a phone call, and it was always to the same person. It was always the same phone call. Simple call. Just, Mom, help. My mom came. She always came. I couldn't go to her, but she would come to me. She walked into my house, and I'm kneeling on the living room floor. I'm crying uncontrollably. I'm shaking apart. I have hepatitis, and I weigh 112 pounds. She took one look at me, and the first words out of my mother's mouth were, I'll kill her for doing this to you. Alcoholism. This is a family disease. Blaming others is a big part of this disease. My mother has it too. I'm not the only one I hurt when I pick up a drink. We made some phone calls, and I found myself in an emergency room. I got a doctor playing with my liver. He says, son, you got an alcohol problem. I said, oh, no, sir, not me. I'm not going to be an alcoholic. I told y'all before I didn't want to be no alcoholic. And I'm laying there vibrating on the table. And we're arguing back and forth about what I'm going to be. He says, son, you got an alcohol problem. And finally, I told him, look, I'm just not going to be no alcoholic. If you want me to, I'll be a drug addict or something else, but I'm not going to be no alcoholic. Like drug addict got some kind of status or something, you know. He says, son, I don't care what you want to be or don't want to be. Call yourself or don't call yourself. You don't stop drinking, you're going to die. And I heard him. They sent me to the east side of Cleveland. They put me in a psych ward. I spent 10 days in that psych ward. I spent 3 days in restraints. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. That sounded like step one a little bit, huh? But it's not. I got a psych ward in my psychiatrist in my psych ward. I got the happiest psychiatrist on earth in my psych ward. And he comes and visits me every morning about 6 o'clock in the morning. Happy? Tim, how you doing? Good to see you. Isn't it a wonderful day? I don't know about the rest of y'all. Tied to a bed, 6 o'clock in the morning. Psych ward on the east side of Cleveland. I'm not real spiritual. I told him what I thought. And then he just did what psychiatrists do. Y'all know what they do. They write in their chart. They nod their head. And they go away. And they make you take that test. You ever take that test? That MMPI test? Got 601 questions on it? I'd like to have a nickel for every time I took that test. They gave me that test every time they put me somewhere. There's only one question on that test I can't answer. It's my favorite one. Do you urinate more than most people? I don't know. I'm the one supposed to be crazy here, right? On a third day, he came into my room. He took those straps off of me. Excuse me. And he sat on the edge of my bed. He put that chart in the windowsill. And I don't ever want to forget that. He said this. He said, Tim, I can't make your wife come home. I don't have a job to give you. I'm not going to make a house payment for you. But if you never want to take another drink, I can tell you how to do that, one day at a time. You see, this psychiatrist was a recovering member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know God wants me here. He sat on the edge of my bed, and he shared a little bit of his story with me. And then I shared a little bit of my story with him. And all of a sudden, it was no longer I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. All of a sudden, it became we. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And that's step one. And I know today that without the we, I don't have a chance. 7 days later, he sent me home. He gave me a prescription. You know what it was? The most valuable thing anybody has ever given me. He gave me a meeting schedule to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, when you get home, I want you to go to a meeting. When you get to that meeting, you get a sponsor. And I got home, and I didn't know what to do. And I told y'all what I do when I don't know what to do. I called my mama. I said, Ma, I got to go to an AA meeting. She said, okay, I'll come get you. My mom knows all about Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been a big book in my house as long as I can remember. She went to meetings with my daddy in the 40s and the 50s. And she took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was July 4th, and it was 1982. She dropped me on your door. And she left me with this advice. I'm going to share it with you. Said, I'm not coming back to get you. You go in a room, you go to the front table, you tell the people at the front table you're new, you don't have a car, you don't have a driver's license, you need a ride home. And you stay away from the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I paid attention to just about half. My mama's advice. But I got a sponsor that night. He gave me stuff to do that night. His wife was a chairperson. She walked up to me and asked me if I'd read the traditions. And I backed up. I said, oh, no, honey, I don't think that's a good idea. They just took straps off me. I mean, you might want to ask somebody else. He looked at me and he said, now, here's your first lesson in AA. You never say no to Alcoholics Anonymous. No matter what the request is, the answer is yes. That's all you're ever going to need to know about that. And then he told me, if you sit in a chair, you put it away. If you dirty an ashtray, you empty it. If you have a cup of coffee, you throw it away. He said, I want you to read one page in the big book every day. I don't want you to turn that page till tomorrow. You read that page as many times that day as you want to or think you need to, but do not turn that page until tomorrow. And just maybe, in 164 days, you might know something about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, if you're not praying, this is the way you're going to start. You're going to use three words I know your mother taught you when you were a little boy. You're going to get up in the morning and kneel down. And you're going to say, please. You're going to go about your day, and at the end of that day, when you haven't had a drink, you're going to kneel back down again, and you're going to say thank you. Please and thank you. You know, my mama did teach me those words when I was a little boy. Do you know what she called them? The magic word. What's the magic word, Timmy? That's what she used to say. I had no idea how much magic those words held until I came here to you, and you showed me how to use them. And then my sponsor asked me that question, and I really believe you got to be careful what you say to new people. He asked me that question. You know that question. He said, do you want what I have? I don't know. What do you got, man? You know, my first sponsor had a brand new Tornado. Wore a Rolex wristwatch. Had a stewardess wife with the prettiest green eyes I ever saw in my life. Do I want what you got? And what page is that on? You know? I didn't know what he was trying to ask me. You see, I don't believe when a new man gets here, he has to want anything. It's not his responsibility to want something to come through that door. But once he comes through that door, it becomes my responsibility to have something he does want. Because when I got here, I did not want what y'all had. But I knew this. I did not want what I had. And that I knew for sure. Because I didn't know what he wanted me to have. Until he told me, the only way you're going to know what I want you to have is when you go give it to somebody else. And that's what I want you to have. But you won't know that till you do it. And I came to believe by watching him and the folks I ran with that my life could change, that the insanity could go away. I came to believe by watching you. And once I believed it could happen, I had to follow through. I knelt down with my sponsor and I said a third-step prayer. He was all about the turn it over, huh? Turn it over. No matter what problem I brought to him, he'd tell me, turn it over, Tim. No matter what it was, I got so tired of turn it over. I want an answer or I'm going off on somebody. And I didn't like the third step prayer because I wasn't sure what I was turning anything over to or what they were going to take. I didn't even know what I had to turn over. And then he explained it to me. They gave me a penny. I always have a penny. You know what you see on the back of the penny? That's on the front. On the back of the penny, you're going to see the Lincoln Memorial. It says 1 cent. But you know what happens when you do turn it over? On the front of the penny, it says, in God, we trust. That's the third step. That step's not got nothing to do with God's will. That's about my will. And what am I willing to do with it? Am I willing to trust God with it? I can tell you that I am today. And if you look farther down that penny, you know what you're going to find? Another word. That word's liberty. And that's what you're going to feel once you can trust God a day at a time. I started on that fourth step, but y'all know that's not one you want to rush right into, right? You got to take your time with that fourth step. You got to read all them books, man. You know, if we ain't got nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous, we got books. We got blue books. We got blue and blue books. We got little blue books. We got little black books. We got little red books. Man, we got books. And you've got to read all them books. Because if you don't read all them books, talk to every old-timer you know, you might mess that fourth step up, right? There's only one way to do the fourth step wrong. Don't do it. That's the only way to do it wrong. I read all them books. I talked to every old-timer in Cleveland. I'm sober 21 years today. And I still don't know what Mr. Jones's problem is. I'm sitting at the house one day and the phone rang. It's my sponsor. He said, how's that four-step coming? I said, well, it's coming right along. Then he gave me something, gave me information. Don't want to give your new guy too much of this either. He said, it'll get done in God's time. And you know, that's what I was thinking too about that fourth step. I said, yeah, it'll get done in God's time. And I hung up the phone. 5 minutes later, the phone rang. It's my sponsor. He said, hey, how's that fourth step coming? I got something now, right? I got information. I give it right back to him. I said, it's going to get done in God's time. He said, well, that's a good thing, Tim, because God's time is tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. He said, I made an appointment for you to do your fifth. That's just the kind of guy my sponsor was. He's always helping. He'd sit behind you at a meeting. They'd say, we need coffee help next month. He'd raise my hand. Tim will do it. Tim still does it. I'm an active member of the West Clifton Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm usually the last one out of that parking lot every Friday night. I like to say goodbye to the people that come. That's what you do at a home group. It's your home. say goodnight to the people that came to visit. If you can get that job at your home group, get it. That's a good job. I did a fourth step and a fifth. And then I had to become entirely ready to have all that stuff go away. I couldn't do it by myself. And that's when I humbly had to ask God for help. Because you know we're all like TVs. Y'all got TVs at the house. You know all them buttons in the back of your TV? Those buttons you ain't supposed to mess with? You mess with them. And you know no matter how much longer you mess with them, you're never going to get them back to where they're supposed to be, are you? And sooner or later, you're going to have to call on a power greater than yourself. The TV repairman. And he's going to come over and he's going to get it back to your TV and he's going to adjust all them buttons the right way. But if you're any kind of a drunk like me, he's not halfway back to his van and I'm behind the TV again. Because I think I can do just a little bit better. Once I asked my God for help, he pointed me at the eighth step in my list. And that's when my sponsor told me I had to make amends. And I looked at that list, and most of the people I needed to make amends to, well, they wronged me too. So I called my sponsor and I said, I got this narrowed down pretty good here. They hurt me, I hurt them, that's a push. But you know how sponsors are. He always got an answer. He said, oh, no, no, that ain't how that works. He said, before you can go out and make amends to anybody else, you have to be able to forgive everybody that ever harmed you. And until you can forgive everybody that ever harmed you, you do not have the right to ask anybody else for forgiveness. And once I learned to forgive, I went out and I made direct amends to the people I've wronged. I didn't write anybody a letter. I never wronged anybody in a letter. If I wronged you, it was up close and it was personal. I know the big book says sometimes a letter will suffice. There was nothing in my eighth step that a letter would suffice. I had to go personally and make direct amends to the people I've wronged. And once I was able to do that, you know, before I was halfway through, those promises started coming true. I got that Lincoln sitting in the driveway tonight. I keep it disguised as a Ford, you know. That's just so no one will steal it. Maybe you'll see it someday. And you'll think, man, that ain't no Lincoln, that's a Ford. But remember this, there's only one person here tonight, only one, that's looking out of your eyes. That's the only person that's ever going to be responsible for what you see. You can see good or you can see bad, but remember, you are the only one looking. Because when I get inside my car, I don't see four. Alcoholics Anonymous is an inside job. I spent most of my life thinking if I could make the outside look good, the inside would feel better. And I was wrong. I get inside my car. I don't see Ford. I see Lincoln. Town car. 2003. It's triple black. Got a moonroof. Got a Bose CD system in it with a 14-disc changer. And when I get inside that car on Monday morning, and I go to the job I didn't used to have when I was drinking, see the friends that I didn't used to have when I was drinking, I'm going to hit that power window. Now, y'all know I could be crazy, huh? But I'm happy. I don't know who has your message, do you? Are you waiting for somebody with 50 years or are you listening? I don't know who God sends to me. Maybe they're sober 50 years. Maybe they're getting ready to get sober in 50 minutes. I know this. If somebody's talking and I can hear them, God wants me to be listening. About 11 years ago, I got a message on the first step. I was invited to speak in Indiana. My wife couldn't come with me that weekend, so I took a new guy with me. I didn't want to take my car because I just didn't think it would make it to Indiana. So I took my wife's car. She drives a Honda Civic. You know a Honda Civic, what do you get in a Honda Civic? 200-300 miles to a gallon, right? You drive a Honda Civic forever, I'm pretty sure. I threw my new guy in the Honda Civic and we headed to Valparaiso, Indiana. We got past the sign that said my exit was about 5 exits away. As soon as we went underneath that sign, I looked at it, and then I looked down at the gas gauge. The gas gauge said empty. And I thought, well, yeah, empty in a real car, empty. You know, but Honda Civic, you got to have 100 miles once it says empty. And there's only 50 left in Indiana. I never thought about it again. Until I went underneath the sign that said my exit was 2 miles. As soon as I went under that sign, I ran out of gas. Now, I coasted for another mile. And I pulled over to the side of the road. If you got a Honda Civic and it says empty, they're dead serious about that. That's exactly what they mean. So here I am, sitting on the side of the road in the middle of Indiana. Got a new guy sitting next to me. I don't even want to turn and look at him. I just spent the better part about 4 hours telling him all about responsibility and stuff like that. But I had to do something. I couldn't sit in Indiana the rest of my life. So I turned and I looked at him. He just grinned. You know how they are. You know that new guy grinned. They'll stay sober for years, just waiting for you to mess something up so they can bring it to your attention. And he looked up at me and he grinned and he said, "We're powerless, ain't we?" I said, "Yeah, you bet we are, buddy." I said, "What do you think we ought to do about that?" He said, "I think we better admit it." I said, "Yeah, because I could sit here the rest of our lives and go, vroom, 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 vroom." But you know, if I don't ever admit there's a problem, I'm never going to get anywhere. I said, "Okay, we're powerless. We admit it. What do we do next?" He said, "I'm pretty sure we're going to take certain steps." And you know, that's exactly what we did. We walked about a mile and a half to the nearest gas station. I don't know who has your message, do you? If someone's talking and you can hear them, that's God. Listen. I have a great life today. I know today how to live resentment free. See, my God lets me hear the things I need to hear the way I need to hear them. Not exactly the way you think I'm supposed to hear them, but the way he knows I'm going to hear them. I walked into the rooms and they told me this too. New guy stuff, be careful. Said, "Pray for your enemies." Huh? You heard this one? Pray for your enemies, man. You know, they just took the straps off me. My wife left, took whatever little bit of my dynasty I had. You know, I don't know about anybody else. I had a few resentments when I got here. I want to do something nice for my ex-wife. I was going to buy her a new car, maybe. Like a 72 Pinto with no brake lights. Something like that, you know? I went to see my little brother. He's a born-again Christian. And I said, "You know what these knuckleheads in Alcoholics Anonymous told me? Pray for your enemy." He He said, you should, Tim, it's true. Tells us to in the Bible. I said, no, it's not. He went and he got his Bible. You know what it says in the Bible? It says, praying for your enemy is like heaping hot coals upon their head. Now, I like that. That's not what you told me. But that's the way my God knew I needed to hear it in order for me to go home, hit my knees, and mention my enemies to my God. And do you know my God doesn't care what I say once I kneel down? He just doesn't care once I take the action. If I go home tonight and I kneel down and I say, dear God, please, please let all my enemies go to heaven tomorrow. God don't care. This is how I live my life today. I take one word from each of the last three steps. Continued, improve, and practice. Now each one of those words is an action word. You got to do something if you want something in this program. My big book says half measures avail me nothing. Doesn't say half measures avail me half. It says nothing. And I don't know about anybody else. I've had more nothing in my life than I want. I don't want any more nothing. I want everything my God wants me to have. And I don't even know what that is. But I want it. There's a difference in my life today. I'm going to share it with you. I go to the prisons. I used to. I don't go as often as I used to. And I talk to the guys in the prisons. And I was reminded. And when your guy asked me, can I call you? I said, sure. And I forgot that when you're in prison, you want to call somebody, you got to call collect. Now, that's not an issue for me. I'll accept a collect phone call, and I'm going to tell you why. On April 4th of 1989, or April 10th of 1989, I walked into a meeting. There was a young lady speaking that night. And I don't know what they tell you in Georgia. But this is my sponsor always told me. You go to a meeting and you hear something you like, take it home. And on October 16th of 1993, I married that woman. I married a young lady in the fellowship. If you're here tomorrow morning, you can hear her story. I married a very intelligent young lady in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, very educated lady in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife been in school since she started going to school. She's still in school. My wife got more letters after her name. She got a BA. She got an MA. Got an MACT. She was ABD. Now she's got a PhD. And she finally got something I wanted her to have. And that's J-O-B. One of my new guys asked me once, he said, doesn't that intimidate you that your wife is so intelligent, that your wife's so educated? Doesn't that intimidate you? I had to stop and think about that for a minute. That's never had before, you know? I said, intimidate me? No, it doesn't intimidate me. It makes me proud as hell. I'm proud as hell of my wife's accomplishments. I can't be intimidated. See, in 1988, when my wife walked through those doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, she didn't have any letters after her name. But with the faith of a God, the women in her home group giving her the strength, telling her that she can be anything she wants to be in this program, she believed them and she took that book of directions, followed it, and proved that they were right. You can be anything you want to be in this program if you take the action. I can't be intimidated by Alcoholics Anonymous and God, and that's where those letters came from. I can only be proud. And I proved it. I got new license plates for my car. You know those vanity plates? I hate those things. I have some, though. You know what my plates say? Say, PhD, GED. I got letters after my name, too. When that boy called me collect, I reminded him when I was in the penitentiary, I tried to make a collect phone call. They took me to the phone, so they put in that bullpen. They told me I had this much time. I could call any bear I wanted. I'd call anybody I wanted, but I had to call collect. I stood there and I dialed. And I dialed. And I dialed some more. And I dialed until I didn't have any time left. You know, I couldn't find one person, not one, on this earth that would accept a collect phone call from me at that time in my life, not one. But on October 16th, 1993, we had a wedding. We had an AA wedding. It started with the Serenity Prayer. It ended with the Lord's Prayer. We had an Elvis impersonator. We had a clam bake, and we invited 320 people to that wedding. You know how many came? About 340. You see, that's the difference. That's the difference from then to now. That's the difference in my life. You want to know the difference in me? About 6 years ago, my stepfather got sick, so I was allowed back in the house. Let me say this for the newcomer. If you're sitting out there and maybe things aren't moving fast enough for you, I'm going to tell you this. I was sober 9 years before I had a driver's license. I was sober 16 years before I was allowed back in my parents' home. These things will happen. Don't leave before they do. My stepfather got sick and I had to take care of him. I think the only reason I was allowed back, and he got Alzheimer's and he probably just forgot he didn't like me. But but I became his caregiver. I was the guy that had to take care of him and my mother. I had to make sure everything was all right. And there's probably weren't two people on this whole earth that hated each other more than me and him. But I had to take care of him. I became his caregiver. He passed away about 2 years ago. And about a year and a half before that, we had to put him in a nursing home. He was just too much work for me and my mom. So every Saturday and Sunday, I'd pick my mom up, and we'd go out to the nursing home to visit. But that left me with an 84-year-old mother. And I take care of my mom today. I talked to her just a little while ago. I always talk to her right before I talk. Make sure she was okay. She's had 3 strokes and a broken hip in the last 3 years. And that's a lot of work. I take care of her. She still lives at home. I have a woman that goes over there during the day, and then after work, I go over there. And I make sure she has her pills, and I write her checks, and I take care of her dog and do her shopping, and whatever she needs done, I make her dinner. That's what I do during the week. And on the weekends, I go over there in the morning. I make her 3 meals. And I make sure she has her pills, and I do whatever she needs done. I take care of my mom today. One of my new guys asked me this. Because on Saturday and Sunday mornings, you know what I like to do? What I used to do? I like to play golf. And my friends still play. I haven't been able to play this year. I've just been too sick with the medication. But they still invite me. They'll call me and they'll say, you want to come Saturday and play? And I'll say, no. I'll be at my mom's. You guys go ahead. And one of them asked me this once. He said, do you have to be at your mom's? I said, no, I don't have to be. I get to be at my mom. That's the difference in me. And I don't go to my mom's because I'm a doctor, that's for sure. I can't fix her if she breaks. I'm not a great cook. That's not why I go to my mom's. I'm not afraid she's going to be dead. That's not why I go to my mom's. You know why I go to my mom? Because I know a loneliness such as few men have known. And the elderly know that. If there's somebody in your life, you're sitting around thinking you should go see them, quit thinking. Do something. That's what we're doing here. Our job is to make sure nobody knows a loneliness such as few men know. And that book tells me it's not just the people here. I'm to be of maximum service to everybody, not just the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I go to my mom. The only reason I can do those things, because on July 4th, 1982, I walked through a door like that. I met people like you. You gave me a book of directions and promised me if I followed them, my life would change, and you didn't lie to me. I'm going to leave you with something my friend Walter used to tell me all the time. Remember this. What you do between the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer isn't as near as important as what you do between the Lord's Prayer and the Serenity Prayer. Thank you so very, very much for my life.